On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who Killed Malcolm X is one of the illest Netflix documentaries to come along in a while. You already know how important Malcolm is and how inspirational he is. I love to hear him speak from the stage and bring that fire. This doc goes into all of that, but also into the detective story around who killed Malcolm, because he was murdered by three gunmen who shot at him at the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem as he was speaking, shot him right in front of his wife and his four young daughters. We know who shot him. We know that the main trigger man did not get caught and was not convicted or punished for the murder. We know that he was a Muslim from Newark. And thanks to this doc, we know that the NYPD knew Malcolm was about to be killed and did nothing. And we know that the FBI, the federal government, had infiltrated Malcolm's organization and the Nation of Islam and was actively trying to sow dissent that would lead to division and perhaps murder. And new out of this doc is this that really kills me. Malcolm's main bodyguard was an NYPD infiltrator and secret informant. Malcolm didn't know. And he was standing right beside Malcolm when he was killed. So he could have saved him. He could have, and this part makes me so mad, he could have helped identify his killer. Don't forget, this is the Patreon era of Toray Show. We got two episodes a week for you now, including a Friday Patreon exclusive for our Patreon supporters. For that, go to patreon.com/Toray Show. For now, it's the two directors of Who Killed Malcolm X on Netflix, Rachel Dretson and Phil Bertelsen on Toray Show.
There are so many things in this documentary that blew me away, and perhaps Malcolm's closest bodyguard was an NYPD plant. That alone, plus he was standing right next to Malcolm when he was assassinated, which means he probably knew who actually pulled the trigger, because I assume William Bradley was closest to Malcolm. And third, the NYPD did not question him, were not made aware of his status as a cop for many years. And you guys spent a lot of time talking to this man.
Well, a couple corrections on that. That was almost right. We didn't actually talk to him because he passed away. What you saw and what you see in the documentary are extensive interviews that were done with him by two other folks who talked to him before he died.
But the
other thing is, it was the district attorney's office,
the prosecutor
that did not tell the.
NYPD did not tell the prosecutor
exactly
that they had a plant in the room.
That's right.
That he was there. He could have said, "No, that guy did it, not those guys."
Theoretically, he could have.
Tell the people about this man, for starters.
Well, I'll start by saying, not only did the NYPD not give him and his name to the prosecution when they were, forming the case for questioning, but they chastised him for actually trying to save Malcolm's life.
CPR.
Yes. Mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, which many conspiracy theorists, suspect he was actually stifling Malcolm's last breath as opposed to trying to give him life. That was his argument anyway to the NYPD, to his superiors, that he was trying to save Malcolm's life. And they're like, why would you do that? You're a cop. He's a thug, I think is the quote.
Right.
And it's really troublesome to hear that was the mentality of those who are, charged with our service and protection. And I shudder to think that may in some ways be true today.
But. Well, how did we get even to, what was this man's name?
Gene Roberts.
How did Gene Roberts enter, it wasn't the Nation of Islam, because this is after Malcolm had left or been kicked out of the Nation of Islam. How did he enter Malcolm's, this is the OAAU era?
It was the OAAU era, and the Malcolm had two organizations at that point.
The Muslim Mosque Incorporated, which was the MMI. So we had a religious organization, which was the MMI, and the OAAU, which was his political arm. Gene essentially infiltrated both as a bodyguard. So he was security. You know, he wasn't aligned as a patron of Malcolm so much as a devotee who was assigned to his security detail.
And he rises up to become his number one guy.
He was his security coordinator. So, you know, it's hard to know if that means he was his number one guy, but he was clearly in a central and important critical role.
Standing literally beside him.
Yes. You know, the part of the story that we don't get to tell is how he actually got exposed years later in the Panther 21 trial here in New York City, celebrated trial that was, you know, won on the part of the Panthers. But Gene Roberts had infiltrated the Panthers, so he left Malcolm's detail, he infiltrated the Panthers, and he was called to witness on this particular day of trial and was a no-show. So everyone's looking around, and they're like, where's Gene? And suddenly they knew who the mole was, at least the attorneys did. And they forced him to testify and basically outed him on the stand. It's a traumatic story. He broke down, you know.
It's an amazing story because the prosecutor who was questioning him, you know, was essentially pushing him to—
It was an attorney, Gerald Leftcourt.
Gerald Leftcourt to, you know, essentially confess that he had been trying to kill Malcolm when he was giving him mouth to mouth. And Gene evidently broke down on the stand. And he was like, no, I loved him. And actually, there is evidence that Gene, you know, the more time that he spent around Malcolm, the more he began to admire him. And by the time Malcolm was dead, Gene actually did love Malcolm, which complicates the whole picture because the NYPD completely distrusted the guy. Completely distrusted him and saw him as having gone over to the other side. So it's a really fascinating story. And actually, after that, you know, Roberts just deteriorated to the point where, you know, he died with his head in a bottle. You know, he was really.
I think that the term was face down on a bar somewhere.
Yeah, no teeth. You know?
So it's a tragic tale of you know, being African American at that time and being part of law enforcement in such a way that your identity was withheld. You were a ghost among, you know, goblins, right? And they ate him up, spit him out.
This is not the only infiltrator who was there at the end. There were 9 other NYPD and FBI infiltrators in the room when Malcolm is killed?
That's just the FBI.
Oh, so 9 FBI people are in the room.
All of whom gave statements to the FBI. But because the FBI and the NYPD were not openly exchanging information, or at least not the FBI with the NYPD, that testimony was never entered into. Those informants were never called to testify or be questioned.
And it is one of those informants, at least one, who pointed to Bradley, not necessarily by name, but a simple process of deduction, as we show in the series, would lead the investigators inevitably to Bradley. One of those FBI informants had actually spoken to someone at a very high-ranking level who told him that the person who pulled the trigger on the shotgun was a lieutenant in the Newark Mosque. And there were only a handful of lieutenants in the Newark Mosque. And
of which Bradley was one.
William Bradley, who got away, but before you even deal with William Bradley, is it your feeling that William Bradley himself, who killed Malcolm X, who fired the kill shot, was an FBI infiltrator or an FBI informant?
We cannot prove that. We don't have the evidence to prove that. The FBI is incredibly protective of their anonymous informants, human informants, as they call them. And so all of those records are heavily redacted. However, the fact that the FBI was sitting on this information and explicitly, as we do see, said that it should not be shared with the NYPD unless it was ordered from on high, suggests that they might have been protecting Bradley. There are other things that point to the possibility that Bradley was being protected by somebody. There was a bank robbery that he was part of.
Some years later.
Indicted for, I believe. Certainly
with
arrested
a sawed-off shotgun.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The same weapon that killed Malcolm.
And he had a co-conspirator in that robbery.
Who went forward and was prosecuted, and suddenly his was just dropped.
His case was dropped. He walked.
So that would suggest perhaps somebody higher up the FBI is saying, we're taking care of this person.
Essentially.
Let's not pursue this. Yeah. I mean, it's speculation.
Time, yeah, it's speculation. And, you know, ultimately Bradley, you know, did do a fair amount of time for a number of horrendous crimes, from assault and battery and, you know.
Well, let's tell the story about armed robbery. William Bradley then, because he comes from the Newark Mosque. He's a lieutenant in the FOI, the Fruit of Islam, known tough guy, criminal, felt very comfortable with a sawed-off shotgun, which is, as you say in the documentary, was not an easy weapon to manipulate.
Right.
And he is the one who is selected to go and kill Malcolm.
Well, there were three weapons that were used.
And five men who conspired.
But the weapon that definitely, inarguably, fired the kill shot was the sawed-off shotgun, which was the first one to hit him and which killed him. And he was.
I think it's also, you know, should be mentioned that he was a ex-Marine. He, you know, he served our country and was honorably discharged and learned to handle those weapons with our tax dollars, paying for it.
But then he becomes a criminal. In the years after he leaves the Marines?
Correct.
Right.
He's a bank robber.
Yep. His rap sheet is big and long. And we were only able to, or Abdurrahman Muhammad, who's our kind of sleuth in the series, was only able to unlock it once he had his Muslim name, which was
Mustafa Shabazz.
But, you know, there's a long list of crimes, several of them committed with a sawed-off shotgun, yes.
And he just walked away.
Walked away into history.
There's some theory that he's actually the man featured in footage outside the Autobahn that day, where he kind of feigns this resistance and then simply straightens up his coat and struts across the camera. It's really spooky.
It's a scene where there was a mob that gathered around the one assassin who was caught on the scene, Talmadge Hayer. And it's a group of police officers, for the most part, who are trying to basically protect him from a mob that's attacking him. And in the black and white footage that was taken of that scene, there is a guy, a heavyset guy with an overcoat and a newspaper in his pocket, who definitely resembles William Bradley. It's many years ago now, who sort of pretends, as Phil says, he sort of feigns to get involved in the scrum. And then he just kind of weirdly pulls himself away and kind of hurriedly walks across the frame in a way that's really hard to understand or explain.
It's hard for me to understand how he could have shot Malcolm in front of about 400 people and nobody was able to go, that guy did it. No, I mean, and we know there was a distraction created beforehand, but surely
that distraction created beforehand should not be underestimated, because all the attention went to those two men who were actually in the middle somewhere. So people's attention went to the center of the crowd and drew their attention away from the rostrum where Malcolm was. And in the front row were the gunmen, who then leapt up and did their dirty work with, you know, Bradley leading the way with the sawed-off shotgun. Not to mention, a visit to the Autobahn and photos will demonstrate to you that there are exits at the front of the Autobahn, right off the stage, where these men could very easily have just dropped their weapons, which they did, and go out unnoticed, and then come around to another entrance where the scrum was happening. So there were multiple entrances. The Autobahn at the time was nothing like it is today. It's been basically truncated, cut in half, and turned into an educational center. But at the time, it was a huge auditorium and ballroom.
There are a couple other things that made it difficult for the assassins to be identified. One is that because there were so many shots that were fired at once, seemingly at once, most people just ducked
and cover.
Just went under their seats. It was terrifying. And so, you know, they were out before many people could notice them. That's number one. Number two, they actually were identified. I mean, these guys were not known to the Harlem audience. They were from the Newark Mosque. So, you know, several eyewitnesses described a heavyset, burly guy, dark skin, firing that shotgun. But, you know, it was chaos. There were lots of eyewitnesses.
And it went uninvestigated.
And that's why the eyewitness testimony that convicted the three convicted assassins is so unreliable, because it was all over the place, the eyewitness testimony.
And so he goes back to Newark and lives out his life, passed away in 2018. But as you talk about in the piece, it's an open secret in Newark that lots of people in the Nation of Islam community in Newark knew. You just say the guy who killed Malcolm and they say, oh yeah, that guy. Like,
it's people just amazing. Knew.
Yeah, yeah. Widely held, open secret. Seemed to be the only person in Newark of any import who wasn't aware of that history was
Cory Booker,
former mayor, now Senator Cory Booker.
You talk to not just people in the street, but you talk to like officials. I mean, Ross Baraka is like, yeah, I've heard that. And who is the lady you talked to?
Lieutenant Governor Sheila Oliver.
Lieutenant Governor.
The highest elected black official in the state of New Jersey.
And
she was
like,
at his funeral.
Yeah. She's like, yeah, I heard that. We don't know, but I heard that.
She counts among her very dear friends his widow, a woman named Carolyn Kelly. I'm not sure she needs to be drawn into this, but, you know, it should be stated that we attempted to get her view on things and talk to her, and she refused to participate.
Mm. But we found the Lieutenant Governor because we actually were filming from outside across the street at his service. And we saw
a security detail.
Yep.
Men talking into their sleeves and federal vehicles. And yeah. I'm thinking, what's that all about?
So we go back, carriage. We play the footage for, who was it? Somebody in the community. I'm like, who's that woman that's being protected? And they're like, that's the Lieutenant Governor of the state. And we're like, no way. And then we called her and asked for an interview. And to our astonishment, she agreed. And to our even greater astonishment, she openly admitted being at his funeral and knowing that this was what he was said to have done.
When I was growing up, it meant so much to hear black voices like James Baldwin and Toni Morrison talk about the black experience, because black stories matter. The next generation of influential black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be black today. From The Wire to Bobby Shmurda, from Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range on Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives have not usually been centered in the telling of American stories. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Turn on NPR today and hear real Black stories, because stories should never be told about us without us being in them. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts. Great Expectations is a new novel from the New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham, a keenly observed novel about a young black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about the main character David's 18 months working for Senator Obama's 2008 presidential campaign.
Along the way, David meets all sorts of people who raise questions about history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that force David to look at his life in a new way and come to terms with his identity as a young Black man in America. Colm McCann says Great Expectations will be one of the most talked about novels of the year. And others have called this book epic, intimate, and brimming with brilliance. It got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, which is a big deal. And it's a coming-of-age story that takes you inside the Obama campaign like nothing else. Great Expectations is an extraordinary book available wherever books are sold.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First.
Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
There's a crazy moment where your host is talking to somebody about William Bradley, and they say, yeah, leave him alone.
Yeah.
Don't mess with him. Don't mess with that. And he says it several times, like, do you don't want to mess with that one? That, you know, and that did not, I mean, you know, make a documentary like this, some of the moments are created. That seemed very real.
Totally yeah. real. Totally real.
We actually were just getting our cameras up and running, and our host, as you call him, but who's really an independent historian, Abdul Rahman Mohammed, knew this man because they hadn't encountered before, and just went up to him, you know, before we were ready, and asked this question, what we're going to do about him. And we just happened to kind of catch it. You'll see it from a low angle. The camera was not quite ready. It's
well, he
steady.
Was mic'd already, so but we he recorded was mic'd, it.
And we got it. And it was. It was a very true moment. You could see and hear the fear in the man's voice.
I think that was before Bradley passed
away. Oh, yeah,
away,
well
right?
before Bradley had passed away.
I mean, it's extraordinary. Just you're making this documentary, and you're looking for William Bradley, and then as you're making, you find out that he passed away as you're searching for him.
On the hunt. Yeah.
Yeah, it was brutal. But in retrospect, it helped us because it freed up a bunch of people to talk who probably wouldn't have talked.
Certainly not in the way they did. I mean, no one outwardly admitted knowing firsthand or having been told by him or anything like that, but there was a much greater willingness to share the lore, as it were.
Now, one of the things that this piece does is it paints this much larger picture, right? Because, you know, yes, William Bradley pulled the trigger, but there's a much larger web of folks who lead to this happening. And I want to go through them in a sort of order, sort of expanding outward. I mean, you can't talk about who killed Malcolm X and truly answer the question without talking about Elijah Muhammad. And he is a critical part of this matrix. What is his part in this?
Well, there's been a lot of speculation about his role in this. But what we know is that he reported to or spoke to on the phone and in person many high-ranking members of the nation and said things about Malcolm that if you understood the way, the sort of coded language in which he spoke, easily could have been, likely could have been, almost definitely could have been, in our opinion, interpreted as an order. Nothing was directly spoken, but the language that he used for those in the know was clearly language that meant to sanction Malcolm's murder. So we're able to kind of trace that in the documentary and look at the ways in which that was then sort of rippled down, down to the ranks. But the nation was, Elijah was very careful to sort of create distance between himself and the rank and file.
What exactly does that sound like from Elijah Muhammad when he tells his people, "I'm going to kill Malcolm," in the coded language? What does he say?
I'm trying to remember some of the exact
I think
language.
The most explicit would be something that his son said here in New York at the Armory to a gathering of the fruit, where he said, you know, that his father was looking for Malcolm's tongue to be cut out and sent back to him in Chicago, which many interpreted.
That's not coded.
Yeah.
Well, I think he said it a little, it was a little less explicit. I think he's, what he said
cut
was
his tongue out.
Malcolm's tongue should be cut out. He didn't say my father asked. He said Malcolm's tongue should be cut out, put in an envelope, and sent to my father. So it was not, and that was probably the most explicit, but it was his son. It wasn't him. So there was a little bit of distance there.
And there's some commentary in a unredacted FBI document that we cover where he says something to the fact that Malcolm should be treated like the Judas that he is. And, you know, that is in itself coded language to suggest that, you know, he's a traitor and should be dealt with as such.
People who know this Malcolm Muhammad story know that part of the key rift between them is when Malcolm discovers that Elijah Muhammad has fathered children with, is it seven younger women?
It's multiple.
In the Nation of Islam? Yeah, I mean, who knows the exact number, but a large multiple of women, young women in the Nation of Islam, which sort of breaks for Malcolm the dream of Elijah Muhammad as this amazing person. So is your documentary positing that the FBI found that information and disseminated it, or that the FBI created that?
No, there's no evidence that the FBI created that. I mean, it's pretty well documented that this in fact happened, that Elijah Muhammad had secretaries and assistants who were young and who were his mistresses. He had an apartment in which he, you know, consorted with them, and there were babies born, illegitimate babies born. And it wasn't just that this broke Malcolm's heart. It really went against everything Elijah Muhammad and the Nation stood for, because adultery was seen as the, you know, cardinal
it
sin.
It was heresy.
So, and Elijah Muhammad was always seen as a very pure, godlike figure.
Divine, I think, is divine. What they describe him
but
as.
But the FBI was key in disseminating this story and making sure Malcolm and others heard it.
They wanted to use it to create a rift between Malcolm and Elijah Muhammad, and between Elijah Muhammad and his most devoted followers.
Well, and even his wife.
And even his wife, there were poison pen letters.
In the same way they did Coretta Scott King, they did Clara.
Because you say that the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, had more infiltrators in the Nation of Islam than in Dr. King's organization, more than in the Black Panthers as well?
Correct.
Yeah. They had what are called top level
informants, which meant they were not only giving, you know, proven information, but in all likelihood being paid for it.
Well, and also that they were in very high ranking positions inside
within the organization.
And there were more high ranking informants inside the Nation than in any other of the organizations at the FBI.
Black civil rights organizations, as it were.
So this rift is key to why Malcolm and Elijah Muhammad break.
Well, you know,
and the FBI made sure that the right people knew about it. So here's an example of COINTELPRO working inside the organization to break it apart.
Well, interestingly enough, you know, that program comes to be known as COINTELPRO, but at the time they were just working out their techniques and practices. It didn't officially get that reference until years later, after Malcolm died, right around the time King was assassinated. And by then they had sharpened their tools in their toolbox and knew exactly what they were doing. Led to the destruction of, and death of many lives.
Why was J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI so afraid of Elijah Muhammad?
Well, they were very afraid of Elijah Muhammad because he had an incredibly extensive devout following.
He had power and influence.
They saw him as a separatist and as a radical threat. Mm-hmm. You know, there was this very interesting FBI document in which they talked about the fear of a black messiah. And they listed, this was actually after Malcolm's death, but they listed Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm and King, I believe,
Stokely Carmichael.
And Stokely as the top contenders for that position. And actually in that same document, which is really chilling, they take credit for helping to exacerbate the rift between Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm, because it was the alliance of the two. I mean, Elijah Muhammad had this kind of religious, incredibly powerful religious following, but Malcolm was this explosive orator, right? And he had the ability to, like, you know, incredible charisma, and they knew it. And so the idea that the two of them would be, you know, the appeal was in severing that connection. Similarly, King and Malcolm, in any way allying, was seen by the FBI as an incredible threat, and they did a lot to try to make sure that didn't happen too.
So what is the FBI's fear of a black messiah? What specifically are they afraid of?
They're basically afraid of losing their grip on the status quo, losing control of a country that is, you know, multi-ethnic, multi-theoretical, and ultimately, you know, Hoover just was there to maintain what they had already secured for themselves. And by they, I mean the powers that be. I mean, they used communism as their tool in all of this that gave them a kind of so-called legal leg to stand on, that it was the communist threat that they perceived was pervasive within these organizations that enabled them to get the warrants for, you know, surveillance and so on. That was, and you know, it's all coming out of the McCarthy era.
So they're afraid. They're first afraid of Elijah Muhammad, and then later they grow even more afraid of Malcolm.
Malcolm wasn't on their radar right away. I mean, Malcolm rose very quickly in the nation.
Well, they did start to surveil him while he was still in prison.
They did, but they didn't necessarily see what he was going to become right away. And then all of a sudden, he's on the scene, and he is incredible.
He's a catalyst.
Yeah. And that's when they start to really pay attention. Also, there was Malcolm spoke out against police brutality very early and very powerfully. And when that happened, the FBI, you can be sure, and New York City's undercover agency, Bossie, really started to pay attention to him.
I think it's also important to add that, you know, the rift between Malcolm and Elijah Muhammad wasn't strictly the kind of salacious rumors around him and his dalliances. They were fundamentally at odds politically, that the Nation of Islam had, as one of its edicts, a kind of apolitical point of view. You were not to get involved in voter registration drives if you were to vote at all. You were not to speak out against governmental authority like Malcolm did, particularly with regard to police brutality, for fear of losing your religious status. That was basically gets to the heart of the Nation of Islam as an economic enterprise, tax-free as a religious organization.
The fear of Malcolm, what does Malcolm's political growth in that last year, when he becomes much more of a global citizen, much more of a thoughtful, not that he wasn't thoughtful before, but just his approach to black liberation and justice becomes much more global, much more thoughtful, much more surgical. He starts talking about, you know, involving the United Nations. He changed from the black nationalist, the ballot or the bullet, to something that in history we would see as much more powerful and much more global. Does that ideological, intellectual shift make the FBI go, we got to get rid of him now? Or were they already saying, we got to get rid of this guy?
That's an excellent question. You know, I would surmise that Malcolm had those leanings long before he was able to express them, and that his divorce, if you will, from the Nation of Islam gave him that opportunity to be his true self. I mean, the level to which his thinking had evolved, his Pan-Africanist thinking had evolved, That was not new. Like, you don't just open up a book and come up with that. That is days and years of scholarship and understanding the interconnection of the diaspora and those of us who've been scattered across the globe and how to harness that power. And that was something that Malcolm understood probably long before he was able to express it. I mean, to the question of whether or not that made him a greater threat, absolutely.
Mm.
Absolutely.
Because you describe, you show he becomes this sort of international ambassador for Black America, and he is received in other countries as a visiting dignitary, and he is just sort of showing up speaking for Black America.
That's right. And it's not just internationally. The other thing that starts to happen is because Malcolm's rhetoric, particularly towards white people, starts to soften somewhat. People, you know, in this country who had been supporters of King's and had seen Malcolm as, you know, dangerous, violent, radical, begin to become more interested in him. And he begins to attract a more...
a broader coalition.
Definitely a more mainstream, broader coalition, which was extremely threatening. And he and King begin to have... dance around the possibility of a meeting, a phone call, you know, and this, again, to law enforcement, particularly to the FBI and Hoover, this is like the worst possible nightmare, is these two guys unified.
Joining forces.
Yeah.
And if you do look at the trajectory of King's political philosophy and what he was heading toward at the end of his life, this idea of getting away from legal protections and looking at poverty and war and, you know, international, you know, military power structures. I mean, that's very similar to Malcolm in an evolutionary
standpoint.
In
the other direction, right? They're moving towards each other in those last months of Malcolm's life.
Thanks so much to Rachel and Phil for an awesome interview. And thanks to you for listening. Join us over at patreon.com/Toure Show for more from them about who killed Malcolm X.
The NYPD intimately knew of the plots to assassinate Malcolm. I mean, they knew the guy was about to be assassinated. And I mean, his house was firebombed a week before he was assassinated. There were multiple threats. There was actually... a call from who was it who called? Was it Gene who called the?
Yes, that he thought he saw a dry run.
Yeah,
Gene Roberts
it was
called
Gene
the
Roberts,
superiors.
Right? Yeah. He called the his boss at BOSI, the Bureau of Special Services and Investigation, to
NYPD's
tell them
Red Squad.
This is in between the firebombing and the assassination. To say, I think I just saw a dress rehearsal for Malcolm's assassination. There was actually a very similar staged altercation in this Audubon Ballroom a week before Malcolm's assassinated, in which something very similar to what ended up happening a week later happened. A diversion in the crowd to try to get people's attention so that they weren't focused on the front of the stage. And according to Gene Roberts, who says this on camera, nobody at the NYPD ever followed up. So bottom line is, they knew it was coming. And we have this extraordinary moment with one of the high-ranking detectives at BOSI, who we were able to interview, Tony Boza, who's now in Minneapolis, who tells us, you know, yeah, we knew that Malcolm needed protection. We knew he was under immediate threat of death. And so I came up with this brilliant plan. Let's offer him protection, document it, and he's going to refuse it. And it was a way of covering their ass. It was a way of, you know, saying they did, but not having to actually do it. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. And what's interesting, of course, is why did Malcolm refuse it? Why did Malcolm say no? And that really goes to his mistrust of the New York City Police Department. Police in general, but particularly the New York City Police Department, which was well-earned. And so it's very hard to know exactly, you know.
Boza characterizes that as a...
yeah.
Cynical gesture.
Yeah.
I would call it more Machiavellian.
Do you see the NYPD in this as evil or incompetent?
Ooh.
It's a great question.
I you know, both those words are too strong. I would never indict the entire police force as being either evil or incompetent. But would I describe them as irresponsible, complicit, yes, in that particular case, for sure.
Apathetic, aggressively irresponsible. Apathetic, bordering on hostile.
It was too orchestrated to be incompetent. And
orchestrated incompetence.
But just shy of evil. I mean, it's look, just, they didn't kill him as far as we can
tell. They didn't pull the trigger.
But there's no question.
They allowed it to happen.
They allowed it to happen. And there is no question that had there been a squadron of police officers there on the scene, they would have caught the guys who did it. They may not have been able to prevent it. But they would have caught the guys who did it.
No question.
That and more right now if you join us at patreon.com/Touré Show. Touré Show gives you fuel to power your dreams because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality, and this show can help. You can find me on Twitter at Touré and on Instagram at Touré Show and on Patreon at patreon.com/Touré Show. Please leave a review on iTunes and talk about the show on social. Touré Show is written by me, Touré, and produced by Jackie Garofano. Our editor is Ryan Woodhall. Our photographers are Chuck Marcus and Shanta Covington. Our booker is Claudia Jean. And we're distributed by DCP Entertainment. And we will be back on Friday and on Wednesday with more amazing guests because the man can't shut us down.